Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and it was about 6 months ago that many of us heard about SOPA for the first time, the Stop Online Piracy Act. It was working its way through Congress when a massive grassroots effort stopped it dead in its tracks. From individual tweets to companies like Tumblr and Wikipedia going dark in protest, the web sent a message that certain provisions in the act intended to curb online piracy would instead stifle innovation and creativity by preventing websites from linking to or hosting content that may contain pirated material. Republican Congressman Daryl Issa of California has been on the front lines of the SOPA conversation and the efforts to draft a more tech-friendly version. He's even been experimenting ways to crowdsource the drafting of legislation to replace SOPA. Now, those on the right and the left who oppose SOPA agree that he is one of the members of Congress who gets it when it comes to tech. He was an entrepreneur in the field before going into government. He's going to be in town next Monday to take part in the Personal Democracy Forum, the annual technology and politics conference here. And he joins us now for a bit of a preview. Congressman Issa, thank you for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you for having me on, and thank you for covering the Personal Democracy Forum. It's, I think, an extremely important annual event, along with some of the others held in Texas and around the country that quite frankly, augment the Silicon Valley and a few other centers of thought that in fact, we're only in the beginning of the expansion of the benefit of technology, and that stifling it would be like cutting off engines at steam.
Is it fair to say that you were a critic of SOPA from the beginning, or did the grassroots response also influence you?
Well, I've been very fortunate. From the time my staff brought me the draft that was released late, I looked at it and said, how could we support any of this? Fundamentally, it was a trial lawyer's dream. It was an expansion of the Justice Department, and all based on the theory that you can't reach offshore sites when, in fact, in the area of pirated poker and other gaming, we'd already seen that there are ways to shut down sites that are offending without making it mass or spending a lot of time in the courts. And that's the reason we offered open, the reason we opened, we started keep the web open.com. And as you said about crowdsourcing, the whole idea of legislation came up with the Madison Project and said, never, never, never again do I want to see a piece of legislation where you, and this was not the Obamacare, but, you know, that you had to pass it before you could find out what was in it. That was what they wanted us to do. They dropped it the last minute. It wasn't available to the public. And as people began to know, even co-sponsors of the bill began dropping off. Hmm. Obviously, the 7,000 tech companies in their websites shutting down, blacking out, or indicating some form of non-acceptance made a difference that probably will be remembered in history as a turning point of intellectual property narrowly versus intellectual property and intellectual rights broadly.
Do you think people mischaracterize this issue and the response as coming from the left of the political spectrum?
Well, I think they did. Ultimately the Constitution and the balance between intellectual property and free speech, that's been something that from our founding fathers who were apolitical through the generations of both parties, we've fought very hard together to maintain those rights. And I certainly had people that would be considered progressives on the left and people significantly to my right who all woke up and said, hold it, this is not the right approach. We've got to do it constitutionally.
Yeah. And you got your start as a businessman in the electronics industry on 37 patents, I read. You're a longtime advocate of lower taxes, free markets, small government. So what's the conservative business-oriented argument against a bill that fights online piracy of corporate content?
Well, I think the important thing is that we already have Article III courts, what you think of as federal district courts. You can go to those. That's a remedy against somebody domestically in the U.S. We also have something called the International Trade Commission, originally started, quite frankly, to be somewhat protectionist, but they are where you see most high-profile patent cases on the importation of everything from cell phones to the iPad being argued, and the Xbox as we speak. So it's not like there isn't a court that is dealing with importation, the only oddity, and this is what the Open Act tries to fix, is that the ITC does not have the jurisdiction over essentially internet importation. By simply giving this historic administrative law judge-oriented court that's part of Department of Commerce, you can have an organization that has only the authority to look externally, only the authority to look at foreign importation, but at the same time has had that mandate for decades and has done an extremely good job. So am I against stopping online piracy? Of course not. I just want to make sure that the tool is surgical and not a chainsaw to repair a tear in the knee that you got sliding into first.
So in response, you, because you don't slide into first.
You don't slide into first. I had to correct myself. And I didn't get to home base yet in this conversation.
Unless you're going back on a pickoff. But anyway, you and Oregon Democratic Senator Ron Wyden, so bipartisan, have introduced Open. And one of the steps that you've taken is an effort to crowdsource the legislation, as you mentioned, at keepthewebopen.com. People can add their own language or edit existing language. Given the nature of most comments pages, do you really think the crowd can write intellectual property legislation?
Well, of course, the nature of the site is somewhat like Wikipedia, but somewhat different in that the idea is these are effectively public comments, but public comments that we ask to be specific and that we make available to everyone else who then goes on to review. So people know this is what I said, maybe not in the best legal form, but this is what I said. This is what I'm saying you should change or strike. Everyone can see who's suggesting that. They can comment on those suggestions. They can even suggest over it. What we see is the fruit that we need to pick in order to make a better bill. And more importantly, never again can someone say, well, everyone's in favor, as they did with SOAP and PIPA. There was an implication, at least here in the House, that only Google objected. 7,000 websites later, we know that isn't true.
Can you name one thing that you've learned from the process? Can you point to something an average citizen added that actually could end up in the final legislation?
Well, certainly what we did learn is that it is critically dangerous to try to do denial of service as part of a strategy to stop piracy. And we learned that from, of all things, the Lawrence Livermore Labs, and in fact the director there, making it very clear that the strategy that was originally in SOPA would, in fact, actually make it easier for tools to be used to make the Internet vulnerable because of the instability that it happens when you deny service in that way. But I think the lesson, and I think the lesson that your listeners want to hear is government can work, but it has to use the private sector has to use tools that get to government. And the idea that you go to the Internet, that you use social networking, that that you don't find out that you're not alone by asking others to participate. If you scream and nobody answers, maybe, in fact, you were the only one. But in the case of SOAP and PIPA, we very quickly realized that we had a vast audience of people, including some who create the very content that's being pirated, who jumped up and said, you're right. Mm. And so can the social networks work on overtime? Yes. Facebook was critical in this. Obviously, there were tweets galore going. And I think most importantly, the leaders in the industry invited in all of the entrepreneurial startups and found solidarity.
Republican Congressman Daryl Issa of California, my guest on WNYC. And as I mentioned, he's going to be in town next week as part of the Personal Democracy Forum, which looks at the intersection of technology and politics. Congressman, before the show today, one of the founders of that told us that the big tech story going into the 2012 election is the rise of big data. That in 2008, it was all about using social media to drive votes. But in 2012, it's all about online data and information to target voters. Do you see that shift?
Oh, we absolutely do. And micro-targeting as a result of that is important. But this is also something where if you want to post-election get a better government, you need access to the data. The strange thing is big data is available in almost any area. If you want to find out what my buying habits are or what the buying habits of my community are, or even the information from the census, you can do it. If you want to find out where government spends money, how the GSA's party was funded, that material is not available, even though it's not if you will, secret. It's simply not put in a format that can be easily harvested. So whether it's harvesting draft legislation or harvesting the spending of government, there's a real opportunity to empower people by making even more of the data on your government side available the way it's available to those of us running for office who want to target and sometimes down to one voter household, target people with information that will move their vote.
I guess the difference might be that individuals aren't generally so organized to take advantage of big data sets, while political parties are. So should people be creeped out by this trend in the election?
I think you should be concerned that in fact you're being robocalled blindly on one hand and pestered, and you're also being micro-targeted with information that may distort what a particular candidate really is all about. So when you're targeted, you need to fight back by Googling or searching to find out more information on the candidate. I always give every voter a suggestion, and that is vote absentee a week ahead of time. And the reason is a decision made a week ahead of time is made without the lies that come in the last few days.
Yes, I've recommended to listeners the same thing. Make up your mind before the last weekend of the campaign, because that's when the BS is really going to fly.
It really does.
Congressman Darrell Issa, my guest. While you're here, can I get your take on a couple of political items?
Sure.
Looks like House Republicans want to force another showdown over the debt ceiling before the election. The last one resulted in the downgrading of the U.S. credit rating. Do you really want to go there again as a big campaign season show?
Well, I won't disagree with you that every time the debt ceiling is raised is an opportunity for awareness of the American people that we continue to pile up debt. And I would disagree that the downgrading wasn't inevitable, because it was. We were going to lose our rating because of the quantity of debt and the size of the deficit. I, for one, can say that my intention is to wanting to make sure that people are acutely aware of the size of our deficit and how dangerous it is. At the end of the day, I have always announced very early on that if in fact I have voted for the budget and I have voted for which had deficits, I voted for appropriations, I have an obligation in that year to vote for increases to meet that level of spending. And I think most Republicans, I think most Democrats should take that same tact, that awareness, debate, maybe days of the people of America understanding that yet another raising is in fact another sign that we haven't balanced the budget. But at the end of the day, anyone who votes for appropriations and then doesn't want to vote to have the debt ceiling adjusted to the same level is being a little disingenuous, and it does happen in both parties.
And liberal economist Paul Krugman was here Monday and said the Republican mantra of job-killing taxes to describe the pre-Bush tax rates isn't supported by the facts. Listen.
After 1993, when Bill Clinton increased taxes, we had such a terrible economy under Bill Clinton. And why, after 2001, when George W. Bush cut taxes, we had such a great economy, right?
So how do you respond to history, according to Paul Krugman?
Well, Paul's distorting a little bit of history, and we all know that there's a time lag. The fact is Bill Clinton got lucky. There was a good economy. His increases were not per se job killing. I might mention, though, that they came on the heels of George Herbert Walker Bush's tax increase to boot, which was on a percentage basis nearly as much. Taxes are part of the problem. They're a rock in the knapsack. My committee, the Committee on Oversight and Reform, deals with something much worse. Regulatory slowness and cost there, the soft cost of successfully getting to market, successfully getting a job, doing what you do that adds a cost to everything, should be much more of a concern. Because if you can make the system work better, if you will, we can make a more efficient automobile, then we can stop arguing about the cost of the gasoline, because you're simply using less. That's part of where Republicans and Democrats should come together and say, let's do everything we can to make our economy as efficient as possible. Obviously, spending has to equal taxation, or the revenue from taxation. And I think inevitably there's a compromise in which Republicans realize that the revenue today is less than the historic average. Well, spending is greater than the historic average, and that's a gap that's got to be closed.
But then, and this will be the last thing,
sure,
if both parties agree that the deficit has to be curbed, why do the Republicans stick to an all spending cuts bottom line rather than the Democrats mostly spending, but maybe a quarter new taxes to shrink the debt without crippling what government does?
Well, I think there's a little code there. Republicans always talk about revenue. Closing loopholes, finding ways to increase revenue is effectively getting taxes from people or entities that you're not currently getting as much taxes from. And Ronald Reagan was big for revenue increases, which is another name for a soft tax increase. I think there's a lot of that that needs to be understood, that Republicans aren't per se completely against it. Do we want to be very surgical in tax changes? Yes. Do we want to not have them abrupt, going from 15 to 43% overnight in some areas? Of course. But on the other hand, Democrats can be a little disingenuous, too, which is they propose cuts, and the cuts are always far out, and history has shown that the cuts don't actually occur. So I would always say to people, look at the first year of any deal. If the first year of a deal has real tax increases and then it doesn't really have the revenue, the cuts until out years, then one side is being disingenuous. On the flip side, if you're going to have revenue increases, they really have to kick in immediately in order to have real gains. And that's where sometimes Republicans will say, well, yeah, we'll agree to these revenue increases, but we're going to do it in the out years. Don't trust the out years, because the out years are promises that are almost never kept. Well, the in years are the years that you really have to look and say, are we getting reform? It's one of the areas of my concern, because there's not enough cutting to balance the budget today. There's not enough tax increases to balance the budget today. But if we don't start today with real reforms, we're not going to get there.
Darrell Issa, Republican California Congressman and Chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Folks, if you want to attend the Personal Democracy Forum and see him and many others, it's next Monday and Tuesday, and we've got a link on our page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. His KeepTheWebOpen.com, the crowdsourcing project, is at that address, keepthewebopen.com, on how to follow up on SOPA. And he is one of the most active tweeters in Congress, at Darrell Issa. Thank you so much for giving us some time. Good luck at PDF. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we'll begin a June series on internet dating with a call-in on your personal do's and don'ts and the best and worst of your experiences. You can call in right now, in fact, at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Tell us about your internet do's and don'ts and the best and worst of what has happened to you. 212-433-9692.